Welcome to Unlocking Brand, a part of our Siegel & Gale Says podcast series. Here, our global brand experts host live case studies, deliver actionable insights, and answer key questions on the topics that matter to brand marketers today.
Which naming trends will impact the technology sector in 2024? In this episode, our Group Director of Naming, Aaron Hall, and General Manager, West Coast, Katie Conway, explore the naming and branding challenges that tech brands face, as well as the lessons that companies across industries can learn from them. Learn how to use AI to empower more efficient brand management, understand naming trends, and how to create branded names that avoid trend pitfalls. This is Siegel & Gale Says.
My name is Katie Conway. I am the general manager of our West Coast operation. For over 12 years before that, I was on our strategy team. And so I've been lucky enough to work with Aaron on a number of naming projects, whether company naming, product naming, or our favorite, naming architectures. Today, we will be discussing the challenges in tech naming and branding today and sharing lessons that you all can take forward as you go on your naming way. Before we introduce Aaron, I want to share a little bit about Siegel & Gale for those who might not know as much about us. We are a global brand experience firm, and we have the gamut of services for branding, whether that's research and strategy that can help define a brand's promise, naming, identity, and experience design to bring that promise to life, and activation tools and strategies that can equip the people in an organization to deliver on those promises. What really gets us out of bed in the morning is using the power of simplicity to help companies navigate the most complex branding challenges, whether that's differentiating in an increasingly crowded market, clarifying an ever-growing portfolio, extra points if that company is decentralized with multiple business units, and determining the right path forward after mergers and acquisitions. One thing that makes us distinct, though there are many, I would like to think, is that we have a team dedicated to naming. All they do is name. And Aaron leads that team. So Aaron, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? How long have you been naming things?
Hi, Katie. Thanks. I have been naming things for 22 years now. I landed my first job during the height of the dot-com crash or dot-com bust here in San Francisco. It was a happy accident. I applied to a Craigslist ad for jobs. That's before Monster and the such. I had no idea what naming marketing assistant meant, but seemed cool. So that was how it all began. I've said this probably 100 times, maybe more, but for 22 years, every day I get up, I wake up, and I'm excited to do what I do because I love naming.
Yeah, that's great. So excited about what you do. What maybe has one of your favorite projects been at Siegel & Gale?
Yeah, so that's hard to pick. It's like picking a favorite child, right? But there are so many projects I love here at Siegel & Gale and over my years. I think to think about it more generally, the projects I love the most are the ones that allow me to really open up that creative engine and let it roar, you know, explore crazy, bold, wild, exciting creative themes. And I think that usually happens when I get to work with founders or CEOs or, you know, sort of the key decision makers. One that comes to mind in particular is one that we named for Google's or Alphabet's X Moonshot Factory, and we named it Chronicle. The founders, Steven and Mike, were such great partners. They really wanted to stand out from their competitors, and they were involved in every aspect of the brand we built. It was a cybersecurity company, and they really wanted to not, from day one, they said, we don't want to sound like gloom, doom, defend, protect from the bad guys. They're going to get you, right? Like every competitor typically does, whether in their name or their messaging. And we really delivered on that with the name Chronicle. It was also just a very collaborative working environment with them, whether the brand strategy that we did that was so unique and different, the messaging, the naming, and the visual identity, which really popped. So I think those are the type of projects, and that one in particular is a great example of the ones I tend to think of as my favorites.
Yeah, I love that case and that work that the team did. It's really great. So why don't we go ahead and dive into our questions? So let's start, Aaron, kind of at a high level. I would love to hear, what are some of the general trends you're seeing when it comes to naming in tech today?
Yeah. So the first place I want to start, because I know the ones everyone on everyone's mind is AI. So we'll get to that in a minute. But I think let's talk about naming styles and naming trends. Over the years in tech, we've seen styles come and go, come in and out of fashion. From gosh, way back when I started, everyone wanted a coined Latin or Greek word as their tech name, company name. And now that's almost been exclusively claimed by pharma. We then had this era of the nonsensical string of letters that helped you get a .com from the web 2.0 era. And I think the trend we see that's the longest lasting, or has been long lasting now, and has been the most recent, is this trend toward real, often short, English words that sometimes are a little abstract, and not super descriptive or metaphorical for what you do, but they connect. And, you know, the trend is ongoing, and it gets increasingly difficult to name to it as more and more of those words get scooped up.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what do you think is driving that trend of real English words?
You know, I think partially it was a backlash from the previous 10 or 15 years of these hard, very sort of forced coined words. And that's not to say some coined words are very elegant, but there were many that weren't. And then the string of letters during Web 2.0, right? Like, people often didn't know how to pronounce the word, and even if they could, it had no meaning. I think we've also seen, based on some custom research we did in 2019 and more recently, is that younger generations, not just millennials, but younger millennials and even Gen Z, have a stronger appetite for these words that can be more abstract or metaphorical and not be as on the nose, but they like those real words that even also push edginess because they're a little different. So I think all of those didn't come into play. Also, I think people, just once they see that a real word like bird can be used for a scooter, everyone else who wants to do a scooter company wants a short, real English word that's a single syllable that has something to do about movement, right? So I think that is also part of it.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me, I love this example you give in a lot of the presentations I've been with you at, just the power of a word to take on so many different meanings. You think about the word caterpillar, and it's this tiny creature that moves really slowly, yet it can become a brand that really moves mountains. So you can do a lot even with these real English words.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point that, you know, we often talk about how literal, you know, interpretation, literal definition says a caterpillar is a little guy. Maybe he ruins a leaf or potentially a limb on a tree. But it's that imagination that lets it become this big, powerful brand. And I think that's what we see people allow these single real English words to do, they allow their imagination to give these meaning, these literal words that might not be related, this power to really be magical.
Yeah. As Stephen is referencing in the chat, it can be difficult to trademark these real English words. So whether on that topic or something else, what advice do you have for people who might want to have a real English word as their name?
Well, for my own benefit, I will share advice because I get asked to make these kinds of names all the time. I would just say, give yourself time. If you think you know that this is the type of name you want, be prepared to take a little time, explore in a different way, explore deep and far. I also think as you look into the metaphors, you have to be prepared to go beyond the obvious. Those on-the-nose words that are so close and communicate very quickly what you do in a very direct way, a metaphorical way, like Stephen was saying, like, yep, those are taken. People have been there already. And so we think about it sometimes, and we don't mean this has to be a wacky word, right, to get what you want, but we sometimes think about it as metaphors in these concentric circles, right? So here's your core idea. And that first circle around it is the close-in metaphors. They're the ones probably in the thesaurus. And we never even look at a thesaurus in our creative process. But those are going to be the ones that people have already been to. They've already trademarked. So then as you start to move into that second and third metaphorical step away, I think that's where you find words that will really start to sing your story in a really beautiful, nuanced way, where your imagination can connect the dots and help you find something that's powerful, you know, real English, et cetera. I think, you know, any good namer will look at all of those levels of connection, but I think you're more likely to find stuff in those sort of steps away. But what my advice is be prepared to look at words that are those few steps away, and let your own imagination, as you're looking at those words, as someone's presenting them to you or you're finding them yourself, let your own imagination have some fun with it and see what's possible.
That's great. So speaking of trends, M&A is something that I've seen many headlines about. We're getting a lot of, you know, questions about support for, you know, brands during M&A. And I know we did some recent research and investigation into the trends around the naming outcomes in M&A scenarios. So can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
Yeah, you know, this was a really interesting project. We partnered with our research team and we looked at, I think it was 3 or 4 years of M&A data. So it wasn't, you know, everything, but it was the more recent 4 years, I think, since COVID or during and since COVID. And we looked at four industries, so healthcare, energy, finance, and technology. And three of those four pieces are up. Technology one's coming soon, timed nicely with this conversation today. What we were surprised by was how few M&A, sort of mergers or acquisitions led to a net new brand name or logo, because we looked at name or logo. Mm-hmm. In the tech sector, we only saw 3% of M&A events lead to a net new brand name. So what we saw more of, and this may be also a moment in time, right, situation where what we saw more of was co-branding or endorsement between the two brands. Maybe that's a migration strategy and they're taking their time to migrate over time. But what we also saw is a lot of them got rolled into one name, most likely the larger company that's doing the larger merger company or the acquiring company. Mm-hmm. What we hope it means is that the brands are taking their time to determine which one of the brands, if either, can stretch to fit, you know, the bigger promise of the new entity and making that decision that way. It's hard to know. We were just looking at data and then seeing the current situation. But we were really surprised. I think in part of that's because we often come into the world of M&A when people hire us to rebrand their merger acquisition. So for us, it seems like there's a lot of them. But yeah, overall, it was a 3% that led to a net new name.
Yeah. You started talking about this a little bit, but I'm curious, what would maybe keep a company from changing their name in this scenario? Why not do that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's the main reason I would think if I were doing this and running it, running the decision would be you conduct some brand equity research on both brands. And it's not just who has more brand equity. That's not really it. Who has more awareness, but instead, what's the new promise? What is the new, you know, value that these two combined companies can provide? And which of the brands can stretch to offer that, right? Which is believable for customers and your consumers and customers. And then likely what they're finding is one of those brands, if the merger is done with a like-kind company, can stretch to fit that, right? And so I think that's probably a main reason. It could be also just it's easier to not change names. I could imagine there are situations where if research was done, neither brand fits particularly well over this new promise. But they're like, you know what? We just don't have the time, energy, marketing dollars, et cetera, and don't want to take the risk of starting fresh.
Yeah, it can be expensive. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned 3%. Did change their names. Are there any interesting examples that you've seen of companies that did change their name in an M&A?
Yeah, you know, it's one that I always hold up as such a beautiful example. And it was when Polycom and Plantronics merged, both valuable brands, both solid quality products, both well-known. And it was a change, right, to a net new name, technically a part of the previous, one of the other companies' names, Poly. But I think that's just such a beautiful example of doing the research, looking at all the options. It's not mine, so I'm giving credit where credit's due out there. But it's just such a beautiful example of how you can create something new and fresh that I think probably was better as a brand and gives them more, you know, brand stretch in the future to fit over this new promise of the two companies.
Yeah, that's a great point. I also think a new name in that scenario provides almost a blank slate. We are now one entity coming together. So even though it had that Poly, it still is a sense of signal that we are one company as opposed to kind of this acquisition.
Well, I just want to add one thing, though, I think that sometimes gets often forgotten is that your brand is not just your name and your logo, right? So that's the only part we looked at because I do names. But I think in the case of something like Poly or other mergers and acquisitions, whether you change your name or not, there's so many other parts of the brand that can be addressed, changed, adapted, evolved. And I think the two most that I'll just talk about, the two most important are brand positioning, right? Brand strategy. What is this new promise? What is the new way you differentiate now that there's two great companies together? How are you going to, you know, stand out in the market as a combined entity? And what is that different? And how are you going to get there? How are you going to tell that to the world? And second, we call it brand-led change. It's employee, you know, brand. How do you bring the two workforces together to create not just efficiency, but a common goal, a common North Star for them to all work toward and all feel like they're kind of contributing to this new brand promise? And I think those two things, whether you change name or not, I would hope that most mergers and acquisitions look into that to create ultimate value. Because as we say often, your brand is, you know, lived and brought to life through your employees. And so if you can really do that work to make that brand come to life that way, I would argue that's probably almost more important than a name change.
Yeah. So one last question on general trends before we move to AI, which I know everyone is dying to talk about and hear your thoughts on. Can you share a few do's and don'ts for naming in 2024?
Yeah. You know, the number one thing I say to everyone who's starting naming and you know, more sophisticated person, naming person who's been through this won't need this one, but make sure you're doing trademark pre-screens or trademark checks before you just move forward with a name. I think the most common challenge we see some of our clients face is internal names are agreed on, or you get a lot of momentum behind them and you take them up to a senior leader and they say, love it. And then you find out later that you can't use it. And so we encourage, well, as part of our process, we obviously do preliminary screening to at least rule out the obviously unavailable. You should know early on and not fall in love with the name early on if you just can't have it. That's the number one. I think also, we all know my propensity for saying you don't always need a name and not selling, trying to convince people they don't need my services. But another one would be ask yourself first if the feature or product version or whatever it is that you're launching can't use an existing name with a modifier or something like that. There's so much power in taking your existing portfolio of product names, feature names, et cetera, and building them over time full of new feature, new meaning. I'm not saying all of it works that way, but at least ask yourself that question before saying, oh, version two of this has to have a new name because how else will we signal it's new? I think also just be, you know, as you search for themes to name, you know, if you're looking at metaphorical names, go a little further out than you might expect. There are all sorts of creative ways to free the mind. I think I'll just say, don't start with the thesaurus. Doesn't mean you don't have to go back there. Just don't start there. Like there's a lot of creative resources on the web. The thesaurus will lead you to the thing everyone else is doing and you don't want that. And then finally, if you are a large client or a large company with lots of product names that come at you from product folks and business folks, just make sure you have a good process in place that you've then also communicated and educated your full enterprise on so that it doesn't just create efficiency, it creates buy-in. It makes people understand, oh, that there is a process. The process serves a certain, you know, point in supporting the brand, et cetera. So those are just some. There's lots of other tips I could give, but those are just a few.
Great. Thank you. All right. So let's move into AI. Question top of everyone's mind. I'm curious, Aaron, can I replace you and your team of eight namers with a generative AI chatbot?
It's the question I think everyone, even beyond naming, is asking themselves right now. Look, let's be realistic. Generative AI generates based on data that it has been fed, right? Is it good at spinning out really sort of expected things and slightly unexpected things that you could do yourself? It just does it faster? Yes. At the moment, and I'm not saying this will last forever, but at the moment, it is not a good namer. It does not find those surprise and delight moments. It doesn't find that third rung metaphorical connection word that's like, oh, wow. I often talk about finding words outside of the common vocabulary, like high school vocabulary words. You had to learn them once in your life. They're stored somewhere back in here. And when you see it, you go, oh, right, I know that word, but no one ever uses it in their daily language, right? it can't find those. It doesn't find those as surprise and delight moments for how to name something creatively. So are we there yet? No. I don't know that until we have general AI that it'll truly be a great creative namer. Could it potentially automate some descriptive naming things, especially in a descriptive portfolio? Perhaps. I still don't think it's there yet, having tried to see how it does with descriptive naming. So if you're a namer at a big company, a tech company, or an agency, I don't think it's coming for your job yet. I still feel pretty confident about that.
All right. Well, you add a lot of value aside from the names that you create. So you're not going anywhere. Don't you worry. So a lot of our clients are coming and asking us, you know, how do I know if I should name my AI technology? You know, when do I know if I should, and how do I do it if I decide to?
Well, I have opinions. I wrote a piece for TechCrunch about this, and I think it's mostly just observational, what I'd seen. There's a couple of things to ask yourself. If you have a new AI tech, you're a larger tech company and you're building an AI piece, or you're an AI startup or an AI company, right? The first question would be like, when should you name it, right? Where in the process, where in its life cycle should you name it? I think what we've seen sometimes and recently is sort of beta things get launched with a full branded creative name, but then the experience isn't particularly great. And so it feels a little bit of a miss, a little bit of an overpromise. I think also another thing, so I guess on that front, you would say, my advice would be, there are ways to name it that are a little bit more descriptive or safe to not imply this full robust experience that a branded name might do. So maybe in that early stage when it's just giving beta features, that's the potentially a better example, a better process. And then when you're ready to launch the full thing, you know, the full experience, then perhaps something more branded, right? Also, what is the AI doing? Is the AI just making the features you have and the experience, your UI, better? So I'm really just interacting with a richer UI. I don't know if it needs a brand. You know, there are ways you could just company name plus AI or something like that to use in marketing to say, hey, new, you know, company name AI is now powering our blah, blah, blah experience, because you want to talk about it. You could just say AI, by the way. But we often see people wanting to like make it their special version. So I do think there's power and potential upsides in at that point where it's just powering the existing experience, not branding it, but maybe using some sort of like AI descriptor. Mm-hmm. However, if it's the thing I get to use, I am interacting directly with this thing that is the AI itself that's giving me a really robust experience, I think, yeah, then you probably want to start to think about giving it some sort of evocative name. Maybe. I mean, there are some that have gone the more descriptive route, but something more distinctive so that it reflects the experience and the emotional connection and that we want the user to have. Then there's also, of course, should you use AI in the name? That's come up a lot. We see that happening a lot. We see it in both ways. And I just mentioned one version, company name plus AI. I think that's kind of an elegant solution. It's a do no harm kind of naming solution because you can always brand it more later. But then we also see a bunch of creative names, OpenAI, XAI, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with AI in them. I have no issue with this, except that I think it's become played out, right? Like it's become a trend. And that's what happens when a cloud was the same way. How many hundreds and hundreds of company names or product names have the word cloud in them? Not that cloud is a bad term, but it's suddenly there were just a lot of cloud names. And so I think we're seeing that start to really show through with AI. So something to consider as you're coming up with your company or your AI tech name.
Yeah, well, I imagine one thing that might be appealing about it is it gives a very clear reference point to what this company does, right? Yeah. But, and you referenced some of these, like what are the downsides though? So like that way I can automatically communicate to someone what I do and what I offer, but right. what are the drawbacks of having something like that in the name?
Well, one drawback could be that as AI, this is my prognosticating a little bit, which as you and I have talked about, I don't love to do. But in the same way that I think cloud at a certain point got associated with a certain kind of product and service, and then it evolved. Cloud became a much different thing. A lot of folks at the time were like, is cloud old? Is it out baggage, right? I think we could see that with AI, with generative AI, general AI, and who knows, you know, the AI of the future, if a lot of these terms, if the term AI becomes too associated with this early era of AI, you may have folks wondering and considering, well, with the next era, the next sort of wave of AI hits that's general and beyond, does AI now mean this other thing, this old thing? I don't know. We've seen it happen a couple of times with a couple of different terms over the years, industry terms. So that would be just one consideration. The other drawback is just it's a term that's in 30 of your competitor names as well.
What should brands be thinking about when it comes to naming their AI technologies?
I think what is the, I would say with this, I'm going to extrapolate or expand this a bit to say it's the same thing any technology company or any company should be thinking about when they come up with a brand for their offering, right? Who's the audience? What do we want them to experience? What promise are we making? What value are we providing? And I think when you think about it more fully like that, right, you start to figure out what that brand you're trying to create is that's beyond the name. So then how do you imbue sort of or translate some of that promise and some of that experience and value and customer and consumer sort of interaction and emotion into the name? There's huge, rich potential to have these AI names out there. And there's some that really do it nicely, right? That bring that rich, vivid sort of consumer or customer experience to life in the name without saying AI per se.
Yeah, awesome. Who comes to mind that you think is doing it well in terms of naming their AI technology or company?
Yeah, look, there's a couple. There's so many. I could go on and on about, I think about this all the time. I love a lot of the names out there. You know, I think DALL-E and Sora are just so great. Short, two syllable, DALL-E for an image generator. Also, I'm a big DALL-E fan. But, you know, as opposed to ChatGPT, and let's just be honest, Sam Altman has said that he regrets the name a little bit. He doesn't like it. He thinks it, you know, and what's funny is we've seen a lot of clients, some of our clients have their product folks say, well, we need to add GPT to our descriptive names and internally so that people know that it's a general AI thing. And you're like, yeah, but even the guy who created that doesn't like it, right? So Sora and DALL-E. And also, look, despite the shift from Bard to Gemini, I still love both names. I love Bard more. I thought that was so strong. Single syllable, right? Gender neutral, or arguably. Gemini is great, just more syllables, but also beautiful, rolls off the tongue. Consonant vowel, which is something we often try to accomplish in global naming. So love those two as well.
Yeah. No, I know you have opinions about acronyms as well, but yeah, GPT, talk about an acronym for like some crazy terminology that, I mean, I understand why they'd want an acronym with what it's supposed to stand for, but yeah, not great.
It feels like, again, speculation here. It feels like it was a code name, project name,
yeah,
descriptive product name. And then the thing was probably became much more popular than their wildest dreams. And so then it was there. It is the thing everyone knows and talks about. So I don't think there's ever a real chance to change it until it takes its huge step forward into some other experience. Right. But it sort of feels like it was a, you know, very descriptive name where ChatGPT, GPT meant something to the people developing it. Yeah, I dislike acronyms and will avoid them at all costs in my naming career.
So you mentioned DALL-E and Sora as great examples of creative names for AI. One that I've come across is Intuit Assist. Mm. And I'm curious your thoughts on, you know, if that is a good way to approach naming in AI.
Yeah, you know what I love about Intuit Assist is it's such a simple way of saying, this thing is here to help you. It's still the Intuit brand. And now we've developed this generative, you know, AI thing that's going to assist you. It's going to help you. It's very similar to maybe a step beyond what I was talking about with, like, they could have just called it Intuit AI, right? To say AI is now powering a lot of what your experience. But by calling it an Intuitive Assist, it's not a branded name. It doesn't set expectations that I'm going to have, you know, these really far-reaching abilities. It's not going to probably generate images for me, but it really does tell me what that value proposition is. It's going to assist me in this smarter, you know, artificially intelligent way. I think that's such a good example of how some, especially finance, right, companies can really use AI naming to communicate something and stand out a little bit without having to go full branded, full metaphorical, evocative naming.
Yeah, that's great. So AI obviously is a very hot part of tech these days, but there's lots of other areas in tech that are emerging or that are niche or super complex. What other areas have you seen that maybe should be readying themselves for a similar kind of gold rush in naming as we're seeing in AI?
You know, one, and I'll speak to it just because we got, I wrote about this on LinkedIn a lot because I was so excited that I got to do this. But one that we got experience with was quantum computing. I think it's obviously the industry exists. It's not like it's brand new. But I think because we got to work with Rigetti to name their quantum computer, their qubit computer, Novera was the name we came up with. But it's really bringing quantum computing or qubit computers to the everyday people. And by that, I don't mean me and you. We could never afford it. But I mean, you know, the academic institutions, maybe the eccentric billionaire or two. So it's really actually going to be in the hands of people who aren't, you know, these just the companies creating them. And I think I read some article, now I'm totally forgetting the number, but the advancement and speed of quantum computing is outpacing Moore's law like crazy. And so if you imagine that, combined with we already have one that's kind of getting into the hands of people, it won't be long before, you know, actual quantum computers, I don't mean next week, but it won't be long before that's more in the consumer and or B2B world, right, offering. And not to mention the quantum computing access through cloud-based services that I think could happen. So I think what we'll see is more and more quantum computing naming start to just be like this land grab that we, you know, we already saw some of it getting, you know, working on the Rigetti project. But, and don't even get me started when quantum computing and AI hit each other. I think then I can't even begin to imagine what that'll look like.
So what advice for brands doing naming in a niche space like qubit computing do you have?
I think the world tends to be your oyster, right? There's a lot more open space, open territory than something that's an established industry or mature, we'll call it industry. One thing I would recommend is, especially when you're kind of starting and maybe I don't want to just talk about startups, but maybe when you've got your company and it's serving up one product or one service, right? Over the years of naming, I have been approached by companies like that who are now 2 years into existence. And they have another product or another service, but their company and their first product share the same name. So one of the pieces of advice I would give is spend some time thinking about that early on, because you may save yourself some trouble and hassle when you become wildly successful and 2 years later have to launch 2 and 3 more products. And when you do that, it doesn't mean that your first product has to have a separate branded name. You could brand your company name and make the product name something more descriptive and then see how it plays out. It all depends on your marketing strategy, who your client or your customers and your are. But I think taking the time to figure out the relationship and the future relationship of potential future products could save you a lot of, you know, heartache in the future when you're like a headache when you're trying to figure out what to do. Or not, and hire me 2 years later, and I'll help you figure it out. But that's the advice I would say, is just take some time, think about what your product naming portfolio might look like and how that will relate to your company name.
And when you think about being a startup in this sort of new tech space, any new tech space, how do you like think about standing out from other startups?
Yeah. So that's the challenge in startup naming, right? I think what we often see is a lot of companies need their name, want their name to truly pop and be different. But that can often lead to what we see in new areas of innovation, fads, naming fads, right? And so I will use an example. I'm not criticizing this per se, but it's another fad we've seen in the qubit and quantum computing world is all the Qs, you know, changing Ks and Cs in an English word to a Q, or, you know, truncating something with a Q or Q this or Q that. And I think what that's exactly what happens in these kind of new industries where everyone's like, well, this is the thing that makes our whole industry or our thing unique. So everyone uses that hook, but then everyone has it and none of them, you know, sort of truly stand out. So I think competitive audits are nice. And that doesn't just mean who's doing what, a business competitive audit. It's a creative competitive audit, right? Like, not just also brand positioning, what they're doing to stand out, but like, what are their names? How can our name fit in, but also stand out? I think if those sorts of naming competitive audits can be done as you're thinking about what to name your company or your product, you may avoid the sort of pitfall of a naming trend, or bad, yeah. I should say.
Awesome. So one question from Sarah, which is, if a company has a strong parent brand, what is your perspective on leaning into descriptive naming versus more metaphorical naming for products, features, so on?
Yeah, I mean, there's no one right answer for this, so I'll give a couple of perspectives. One is, it depends on who your customers are. If your customers tend to be, let's say, B2B or engineers, or the type who tend to want to buy your parent company's brand, it's a strong brand. Cisco is a great example. They are the best. Everyone loves Cisco. The brand itself, right, has equity research that says that they are trusted, high quality, et cetera. So they can lean into a more descriptive naming model for all of their products, because people go to Cisco and then they just want to find the thing that they need. Wayfinding becomes the most important type of, you know, goal for that kind of product naming. But it also depends on who your customers are. If they are consumers or other types, it could be some business users, right? Business customers. And if the relationship you need them to have with that product is so distinct from another product or from your company, right? If the company is full of very different kinds of experiences through their products, you may need those products to have metaphorical hooks for the customer to have that relationship with that product brand. It's not one we recommend often. It happens though, right? By and large, if you have a very strong parent brand and you have products that expand the world of what that parent brand promises and offers, then descriptive naming is a very powerful tool for that. But if you may have an outlier. So you may have that system and you may have one product that just sits apart. You need that to be the metaphorical name. So there is a place for a strong parent brand and products that are metaphorical. I think what we end up seeing over-indexed on, and people actually come, Katie and I worked on, I think, 20 naming architectures in the last 4 years. What we see is that the runaway toward creative naming, because salespeople, product people think, well, this thing's new and it's really going to shake up the industry or shake up our company. We need to name it something creative. Now, look, we wouldn't want them to feel any other way as branders, because this is their life. They've spent all of their working hours on building this thing. The salespeople are spending all of their time thinking, how do I sell this thing? And then, you know, so they're passionate, they're excited. Of course, their mind goes to wanting to call it something cool and hip. Cool. But what is our brand strategy? What is the right thing for the parent brand? Yeah. Sometimes it might be, like we talked about a moment ago, a creative name. Often, the thing that's going to get that product, feature, service, whatever it is, noticed and bought and used is something that says what it is or what it does for you or what value it brings, right, to the customer. So I think that's a lot of the different thinking that goes into that. There's no one right answer. We tend to lean toward the descriptive naming. Let's start there and see when and where we might place creative naming in our portfolio for impact, not let's name everything creatively because that's the way to get customers' attention. I think that's a fallacy that, you know, it's instinctive. We think that that's the way it works, but it ends up when you have too many brands, you get what we call brand soup, and then no one knows which brand is right for them or what it means or why they should pay attention.
Yeah, it can be. I like how you talked about using creative naming in that instance as a strategic tool to elevate certain products potentially or services.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's one that I think is super interesting and I would love your perspective on. We have somebody who's commented that we see a trend kind of where legacy organizations are splitting into different organizations or different entities, one that's more B2B and one that's more B2C. So think of Johnson & Johnson and Kenvue, right? And it seems that the B2B side of the business or the RemainCo is keeping the name, whereas the consumer side is where a new name is being developed and created. Is that kind of true? And if so, let's prognosticate and hypothesize here. Why might having a new name for a consumer side of the business make more sense than that business to business side?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's true or not as a trend, but I can say that, you know, the reason I could imagine this would work, right, is the B2B side is, it tends to be the longer relationships you have with these business customers, the trust, the reliability is so important to B2B customers. And so you probably want to signal that, hey, yes, we've split apart, but you still get the same great everything you've ever known for decades with us, whatever. So there's a reason I think that makes sense. I think I could potentially see that when you're going and creating that new consumer entity, as I've said in the previous answer, I think, when you have that consumer audience, there's this opportunity to find that creative way to speak to their sort of emotional, their psychological experience with your brand. And so maybe there's an opportunity for that fresh start to re-promise, hey, now that we're solely focused on you, consumer, this is our new look, feel, promise, name, brand, et cetera. I think that would be a reason I could imagine them doing it that way. But I, you know, the one we did, right? HP and HPE didn't quite do it that way. But I know that one reason HPE kept, because they were the SpinCo, right? Kept the HP part was that that continuity, that trust that was already in the brand. Like, why throw that away? So I think at least that part of why the B2B company would keep that side, I feel pretty confident in saying that's at least a huge factor.
Yeah. So I'm going to switch it up a bit because we got a question from Tanya, and I want to make sure that it's communicated properly. So Tanya, we're going to go ahead and ask you to take yourself off mute and ask Aaron your question. I think it's a super interesting one.
Uh-oh, I'm in the hot seat.
Here we go.
So my question is about different naming strategies, particularly evocative versus descriptive names, when you may have a portfolio that includes services as well as products with interfaces. And so I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit more about those different strategies and how you might approach services versus products.
Yeah. I think when we do work with companies whose portfolios include products, features, services, et cetera. And I think it becomes a couple of considerations come into play, right? One is nestling, so for example, for features, which I know you didn't exactly ask about, but like when features are often part of a product, how you don't want them drawing away from the product experience. You want that consumer having experience with the product brand. But is there an opportunity to be somewhat creative in the descriptive way you do it? With services, my instinct to start, and of course this can change as you learn more and more about a company and their needs, but services should be clear about what service it is you're offering. What do I get? So descriptive naming is my go-to for services. It doesn't mean it's the only ever answer, but like you want to have people understand it, since it is an interaction, it's a service, it's something that is being sort of hopefully custom tailored or at least served up to me in a unique way, what that is. And so the quickest and easiest way to do that is through descriptive naming. Now, if you have millions of dollars to launch a creative name for a service you're providing, and it's going to be one of the primary things your company does in the next few years, and it's really going to differentiate you, and it's a huge move forward in a different direction, yeah, a creative name might be something worth exploring. I always say anything can be explored as an alternative, right? Creative names could be explored in a descriptive portfolio, but then you have to ask yourself, what does that creative name accomplish? Does it accomplish your goals? What are your goals for that service naming? Is it that the people feel often with service naming, that they can trust, that you've got their backs, you've got them covered, you're providing added value, right? Does a creative metaphor do that? Or does it take them a step or two? We talked about the 2-3 steps away to translate that metaphor into, oh, that's a metaphor for efficiency. Okay, so the service must be something about helping me be more efficient, right? That's a thought process they have to go through to get to the fact that this is a service to create efficiency for you. So it's how quickly do you, we've seen this a lot in in financial naming, that customers, we have research, customers want you to tell them what it is. By and large, there are certain things, credit cards and other parts, that they're going to want a little more, you know, creative naming and just connection to. But by and large, have the naming get out of the way. Have it help that customer figure out what it is you're saying you offer, what it does for them, and then let the experience of that service do the work, not the name have to, you know, kind of be the hook that then they try and understand as a way in to what that service actually does.
Great. Thank you, Tania, and thank you, Aaron. So given that we're headed towards the end of our hour here, to kind of wrap us up, what is the most important consideration when naming AI or new tech?
Don't rush it. And I'm not saying take 3 months to do it, but I think because AI is literally exploding, right? It's the exponential growth is insane. I think we want everything to move at that lightning speed. But when we make brand decisions and name decisions at lightning speed, there'll probably be decisions we may have to revisit and change that are harder and more costly to change in the future. So think about, as I've talked a little bit about today, is what are the strategic implications? What would your first product and company name be? What would your future product, could your future products be? And how would you name those, et cetera? So just when I say take a beat, take a slight step back and look at the bigger picture of where this name needs to fit in and who it needs to speak to and what it needs to accomplish. And yeah, then get naming, go. But yeah, just take that moment of reflection first.
Yeah. So for those who maybe didn't take a beat or find themselves, you know, having a name that maybe turns out being a misstep as a result of a trend pitfall, is there a way to correct it? What would you tell them?
This is tricky. I mean, we get asked to help with this. The first thing I would do, the first thing I'd recommend is do some legitimate brand research on the topic, right? With consumers or your customers and your potential customers. Go find out if it's an actual problem. Is it holding you back? I think, you know, we did this for a big client that called me up one time and said, hey, we think our 30-year-old name communicates the wrong thing. It's our old service. We're offering these new things. I had heard of them, and it's very obscure B2B tech, right? We did research and found out that all of their customers and potential customers were like, no, this is the most valuable thing about your company. Like, don't change it, right? So there are cases where, sure, it might have been a fad. It might be nodding to some bygone era, but maybe it doesn't need change. If it does, you know, consider a name change. But again, much like the take a beat recommendation, think through it, potentially work with someone who's done some rebrands and some name changes before. And that might be agency or just someone on your team, right? Who's already been through a name change either at your company or a product change. And then I think really think through the naming process, get the right name so that it's future forward and won't need to change again someday. But then most importantly, how are you going to message this change to your audiences? It's often best done in a rev cycle. Right. So that it's like, hey, this thing maybe even stays on as V1 and 2, and then V3 and 4 and 5 and 6 are the new thing, the new name, the new brand. That helps. Because the last thing you want to do, and I love this term growing up on a ranch, you don't want to slap lipstick on a pig, right? Like, you know, what does it say? Like, hey, we changed the name because the old name was a fad. No, like, have it mean something. Have the new name represent some change to the business, to the product, to the service, et cetera. It's not easy. Name changes aren't easy. But the most important thing I encourage you to think about is how are you going to communicate the importance and the rationale for that change to your audiences? Don't just launch it and say, well, there it is. There's a new one. You could risk losing customers and losing confidence and trust in the brand if you do that.
Yeah. Bring them along on the journey a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you referenced this a little bit, and I know you and I have worked with many clients that run into this challenge where we're working with, you know, the brand team, and they are engaging with many different BUs or product teams that want to name everything, but it's not necessarily the right move for the brand or the brand strategy. So what advice do you have for those leaders on how to navigate that?
Yeah. This is the one that I talked about earlier. You and I have done this so many times since sort of 2020. You want people who are excited about the thing they've been working on to want it cool name because that's their passion. But my advice is that if you don't have a naming system with naming rules, et cetera, that ladder up to supporting the brand. Why do we have these rules? Well, not just because someone said we have to have rules, but because they serve the brand purpose. The brand, they elevate the brand, or they ladder up to the brand, or they, you know, speak to our customers, they achieve customer this, that, the other. What is that? Sort of, how do they achieve those goals? Number one. Number two, highly recommend, if you haven't built that system or are updating it and are building it anew, bring in the products or other, you know, groups throughout the enterprise as you do, right? Get their feedback, get their pain points. What are they trying to solve for? Because maybe it's something you hadn't realized and we can work that into the naming system, or at least use rationale in the naming system to say why the kinds of things we're doing still address their concerns, right? I think one of the things we see is when you have people, companies with people who just want to name everything, name it cool, they don't often know, there may be naming rules, but they don't know like much about them. So educating your enterprise, the roadshow or whatever it is, I sometimes talk about building a series of allies or champions, right? So like pick different people throughout different groups, make them part of the naming champions or naming allies group, right? And the point is like they become micro experts on the topic, and then they can kind of bring that knowledge of the strategy behind it all out there. And what both of these things do, educating everyone, bringing them in, creating some system of or series, a group of allies, is it will help you move your brand team or your naming team out of being a brand cop, right? That's where a lot of us feel we are sometimes, like, no, to brand partner. Right. The more you help everyone understand why our naming system is what it is, what it helped us achieve as a company and a brand and a business, they then will see you as, oh, those are the guys I go to that help me find the name for my thing. Now, sure, sometimes once you're still going to have people who want to name it with, you know, some coined word and an at sign in the middle or something. Sure. But I think what we can move toward, and this is, it's really powerful when you see this happen in an organization where they move from that brand cop persona, which they don't want, they just have, to the brand partner, the naming that starts to take place, the relationships that start to build, and the outcomes for the business are truly remarkable.
Yeah, great. All right, bring us home with our last question here. What advice do you have for brand leaders who are embarking on a naming journey?
Yeah, it's fun, obviously. I love doing it. It's 22 years I've been doing this. Naming is fun, but it's hard, right? And I think the best way to approach that difficult aspect of it is to talk to someone who's been through a successful naming project before. That could be someone like me. It doesn't mean you have to hire someone right away, but like get some advice, reach out. It might be someone on your team, it might be a colleague at a different company or a friend who works at a different company. Talk to them about what worked. What was their experience like? What process did they go through? What were unexpected hurdles that they faced that even though the process that they used with someone was great, at the very end, so-and-so just said they didn't love it. How did they deal with that, right? Getting through, you know, sort of starting to understand what those roadblocks are, how they could have done it, what they would have done differently, et cetera, I think really will help you know what to expect and understand the nuances of it. And I think that's a huge start. Like, so if you're, yeah, I might want to name something, just start talking to a few folks who have named things before. And that's a great place to start.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you, Aaron, so much for sharing your wisdom and insights with us. And thank you, everyone who joined us today and shot us some questions. We really appreciate your time. You know, as I reflect on what you shared in our conversation, there's a few things that stand out to me. I think one is the importance of imagination. This was something you talked about at the beginning, but it is, you know, I think what can turn a, you know, word on a blank page into a very powerful brand. So I really think that is a nice takeaway here. I also heard you mention multiple times like the importance of the audience that this name is for and really putting them at the center of thinking about what is best and what will be most clear for them. And then the other thing, and I appreciate this maybe more so than others because I am a brand strategist, but you know, I heard you reference a lot around the name can do a lot of things for you. It's that first word of the story, but don't forget about all those other branding tools in your toolbox. The role of messaging, the role of identity, the role of bringing people along in your process or after. So those are some of kind of the things that have stuck with me. So thanks so much. And thank you all again for joining us.
Thank you for listening. You can learn more about our work and read our thought leadership on SiegelGale.com. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcast or wherever you listen. While you're at it, leave us a review. See you next time.